I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. Welcome back, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
Now, it's not so often these days that when you catch up with friends at a coffee shop or organise a night out that you spend all your time talking about COVID and its regulation, but just today in Western Australia, all of the COVID regulation, or most of it's coming to an end. I suppose there might be some meetings at coffee shops and restaurants to celebrate that. What do you make of the period and what's happening with the ending of regulation?
It is really fascinating, isn't it? I think you could almost say it hasn't been the end of COVID, because that's the irony. COVID continues and it's in the population, etc. But it's almost like it's the formal end, especially with the end of the state of emergency. It's the formal end to a whole range of different government and lifestyle and social frameworks that we've implemented to try and adjust to the pandemic. So it is actually quite a milestone. I think they're entering with a whimper, not with a bang. So most people are probably not even aware that, you know, this is the end of a lot of our remaining COVID restrictions. It's drifted out of public consciousness very quickly, and people have really embraced living with COVID for the most part. Now, I'm not saying everyone. There's still some people who are worried in the community. You still see some masks out and about. But I think that the majority of the population have now, resumed fairly normal transmission. There's a few restrictions around, for instance, travel. When you go overseas, there's restrictions. We've got triple vax on international travel still, those sorts of things. But for the most part, we're living lives that are pretty similar to how we lived them in 2019.
Well, it probably means the anti-vaxxers and the vaxxers can start talking more rationally to each other in the period ahead, which, of course, raises that whole spectrum of civil liberties and individual rights and how community works vis-a-vis the libertarians and the whole politics of it, the ditch Dan, because Victoria had such a long lockdown, and there are elections coming up there. But we still have a relatively new Labor government, the Albanese government in Canberra, and some of the polls are starting to trickle out at the moment. Martin, what have you made of the polls?
Well, I don't think they're that surprising, really. A newly elected government tends to have a glow around them for some time. And usually that's at least 3 to 6 months, unless there's a major misstep or bungle, etc. One thing the government's budget did focus on was delivery of election promises and no new surprises. And I think that's why their public opinion's held up. If you recall, the one thing that really hurt the Abbott government when it came in, it was doing well, it was flying high until the first budget came in and announced all these cuts, which were completely unanticipated, some of which directly contradicted what they said before the election. And if you look at the poll numbers for Tony Abbott, they plummeted at that point in time and never recovered. But if you look at Turnbull and Morrison, they both did pretty well initially, and then obviously the baggage caught up with them, the internal fighting, in Morrison's case, the bushfires and things like that. So you normally enjoy a bit of a honeymoon period, and the government's still going through that at the moment, notwithstanding there's some significant policy challenges on the horizon.
Martin, one of the regular parts of our broader political landscape, locally here within the state, nationally within Australia, but also right through the international community, is carbon, reaching net zero by 2050, or in some countries like Sweden, I think 2045. COP27, the next big international talk fest, is on in Egypt quite soon. It hardly seems it just finished in Glasgow. And our PM, it seems, just too busy and got too many other priorities to attend to here. And he's sending his climate minister, Chris Bowen. Is that good politics?
I was a little bit surprised by that. If he was leading a government which was not ambitious in that respect at all, that wouldn't be surprising, because when you turn up to these things, there's usually an expectation that you announce or at least reinforce some of the existing things that you're doing. But, you know, the government has enacted new climate change legislation. It does have certain initiatives it's spruiking and promoting. So I think it would have been an opportunity there for Anthony Albanese to better push his case. He has travelled a reasonable amount overseas already since he started. Maybe that's playing on his mind somewhat. And there are some domestic challenges, particularly around cost of living, that he knows he needs to address. Perhaps that's a consideration. But I would still see it as somewhat a bit of an opportunity missed for him not to be there, because a lot of the other world leaders are there. The new British PM's there. They're an opportunity to meet someone like him on the sidelines. And it's increasingly the showcasing of what international leaders are doing. It can be a talk fest, of course. And, you know, we've had the COP conferences, and before that, you go right back to Kyoto, et cetera. We've been talking about this at international level for a long time. And what people want to see from that conference is what are the actual concrete outcomes and how are we actually going to achieve them?
Well, you get the impression that Thunberg, who's not going, probably would agree with Anthony Albanese's stance, albeit for different reasons. She thinks there's just going to be a whole lot of greenwashing going on in Egypt, so why would you go? What would be interesting to see, Martin, would be who the American representatives are. They're about to go to their midterm elections, and I've got no idea what the current state of play is, but one of the fears for the Democrats is they'll lose control of Congress completely. What's your take on that at the moment?
I think they really are in danger of losing control, at least of one house, but possibly both. And it's their argument for re-election is a tough one, because they've got a Democrat president and Democrat control of both houses. You know, the Senate's very, very dicey. But what then can you say? So if they say, you know, vote for us, so we'll do this, the natural response is, but you haven't done that already. And this is the slightly poison challenge you can get sometimes when you control both houses. There's an expectation that you get things done. But American politics is very different to Australian politics. There's plenty of rogue representatives, and they haven't been able to push some of their stuff through the Senate in the way that they would have liked. And that's despite having Democrat senators. So I think their argument's quite a tough one to make. There have been some polarising issues in the US, particularly around abortion, the Supreme Court judge ruling, and they're using that issue to try and drive turnout, because turnout's obviously a critical thing. The challenge with that is midterms generally have fairly low turnouts. They never have quite the same turnout as a presidential election does. And almost always when a new president is elected at the first midterms, their party goes backwards. So there's a long tradition of this. So holding the line for the Democrats will be quite challenging. And I'm sure the Republicans see a lot of opportunities here.
If the Democrats were to hold the Senate, for example, but lose control of the House of Representatives, what would the likely impact be on the government of the United States, taking into account that they're effectively fighting a war in Ukraine? They've got their own domestic cost of living pressures, as we all have, and they're struggling with the same range, for example, of climate and environmental issues that the rest of us are.
Yeah, I mean, the short and easy answer is it makes it much harder than it already is to drive an agenda. Already with the different collection of Democrats they've had to make compromises on the president's agenda and the broader agenda of the Democrats. It'll get much, much harder. The most messiest scenario would be if enough Republicans start opposing the war with Ukraine and start pulling back on support there. That would create a lot of challenges for the US internationally. But domestically is probably where the biggest impact will be felt. And you mentioned energy, and that's absolutely at the forefront of this. So the Democrat agenda has been around diversifying their energy sources and promoting renewable energy sources. And that's running into a lot of flack, both with Republicans, but with, you know, some of these challenging manufacturing areas and, you know, car manufacturing areas in the north of the Midwest. So, you know, there's a lot of domestic issues that they find harder to get traction on.
The US, of course, have very few, if any, controls over political donations and spending. They can do what they like, really, under a totally capitalist model of politics. But there's talk again in Australia of capping political donations and spending. And new senator, former star rugby player David Pocock, who represents the ACT and the Australian Senate, is all in favour. There's quite a bit of talk going around, as we know, through the relevant committee in Canberra, and even chatter at the domestic level here in Western Australia. But what do you make of the likelihood of something like that happening at the Commonwealth level?
It's a more like this scenario. There has been some legislation on political donations under the previous government, but I think that the Labor government has more ambitious plans here. Previously, the major parties never wanted to go near caps on either donations or spending. Why? Because they were the biggest beneficiaries of that. It's just the way, you know, why would the people that benefit from a system vote to change it? That changed with a fellow called Clive Palmer, who came in and outspent the major parties enormously at the last election, showed what is possible under our electoral finance laws, because they are pretty lax compared to a range of other countries. And certainly Labor at the least, but even the Liberals might consider some caps on political donations and spending on that account. And certainly if Labor was to go down that path, I think there's enough support for it in the Senate from the minor parties who don't benefit from that as much. So there's a distinct possibility of some caps on either donations or spending at the federal level. It's also pretty clear that the WA government is planning further reform in this area. They've indicated so publicly. So it'll be interesting to see what final version comes out locally here in Western Australia.
Martin, I suspect just at the moment the Liberal Party in Western Australia at the state level would probably be in favour of putting caps on political donations and spending, given they're so weak with a few representatives in the parliament. Gareth Parker from 6PR and former WA West Australian newspapers political journalist wrote a piece suggesting that the Libs had forgotten about how to win the war and were having too many local skirmishes. Did you tend to support that view of Gareth's?
Oh, look, it's hard to deny that the Liberal Party in Western Australia is in shocking shape. I think it's pretty apparent to every single person, including plenty of people in the Liberal Party. And what has been problematic for them is obviously they did terribly at the last election. And yet, you know, a year and a half on, there's still recriminations and, you know, allegations of branch stacking and all of those sorts of things. There have been some reforms to give members more say, I should say that. So the outgoing president worked hard on that and got some traction. But they've still got a lot of divisions within the party, and I think there's still a lot of enmity inside. They've got to work really hard now to unite, get behind the few representatives they do have, try to articulate a common message, and just hammer the government on some key basic things. And opposition's not pretty, it's not fun, it's not exciting, it doesn't make you that popular. But you start by holding the government to account and you work on those things. And I mean, I think they've done enough navel gazing and looking at each other now. I think it's all just got to be focused on what your message is to the public. And they don't need to focus on the 2025 pitch yet. That's too far down the road. I think they've just got to focus on holding, you know, critiquing the elements of governance that haven't been working. And every government goes through that. So there's plenty of opportunities.
Martin, we're just about at the end of our chat today, but it would be remiss of me not to mention Cassius, the young Aboriginal lad whose life was so cruelly ended quite recently. We've seen vigils right around the country. It's been quite amazing to watch, as sad as it is. And his mother has been a shining light through the process. It's something which others have commented you can't believe could be happening in Australia in this day and age. Is it the sort of thing that will help to bind a community? Will we again learn lessons from it, whatever they might be?
Yeah, it's what the circumstances, as we've heard reported, are awful and shocking. And, you know, we can't comment on them directly, but we certainly expect justice. And it's given those circumstances, it's not surprising that so many people in the Indigenous community, as well as the non-Indigenous community, are shocked and outraged. For this to be happening in 2022. But the other thing that many people, prominent voices in the Indigenous community pointed out is it's the worst element of an existing ongoing, pieces of racism that they face on a daily basis. So whilst this is shocking and awful, it's only the most manifest example of something that they're facing regularly. So I think that's where that anger's come from, and that sense of frustration. Yes, you hope that it's a wake up call to people, but you know, unfortunately, there's a long history of this, and I think you talked about Cassius's mum, and you know, it must be so hard for her to remain so resilient and also graceful in the way that she's approached that as well, and seeking to build bridges. That's not easy. So absolutely. It reminds me a little bit of Rosie Batty and how she worked to try and eradicate domestic violence, and incredibly had her motives questioned after everything that she'd been through, you know. But I really hope that people we'll find her message poignant.
Thank you, Martin. It's a difficult but important topic. But on that somber note, we'll finish View from the Roundhouse today. Thank you for joining me once again, and look forward to seeing you soon.
You're very welcome, Michael. It's always good to talk.